Welcome to week 5 audio of Consciousness, the web course, via the Center for Consciousness Studies, University of Arizona, and taught by Dr. Bernard Barres and Dr. Katie McGovern, whom we shall consider as context for this week, because she works behind the scenes, writing lectures and so on, but she hasn't been heard from yet, except in the first week. The topic for this week is Unconscious Context Changes Consciousness, and I will repeat that for clarity. Unconscious things, which we will call context for our purposes, change consciousness, and we will give a number of other examples of that during this audio talk and during the P-Lab and during the lecture for this week as well. You just heard Alexander's Ragtime Band, a jazz classic for those of you familiar with jazz. And if you're not tapping your fingers to the music, you probably were not paying attention. You might want to replay it just to see how much fun it is. Why is Alexander's Ragtime Band relevant to consciousness? One reason is that we often use music like that to change our mood. And we can think of moods as contexts which frame our experience, especially emotionally and interpersonally, and actually in a number of other ways as well. As you know, we define contexts in this course as an unconscious way of framing and shaping conscious experiences. So after hearing happy music, like Alexander's Ragtime Band, we might feel happy afterwards, even after we've forgotten why we are in a happy mood. So conscious experiences set up contexts that shape later conscious experiences. I'm not sure if it is the case that all contexts are evoked by conscious experiences in the first place, the way you might set the scene on the stage of a theater, and then basically when the audience comes in, they don't know that you've been working hard to set up the stage. They don't see that, but it's happening, of course, all the time. I don't know if that's always the case with human consciousness. I do know, because of the evidence, of course, that it happens a lot of the time. So a lot of the things we do at this moment will set the context for later on when we no longer remember what happened in this particular moment. And yet it has consequences that propagate down the line in our conscious experience. That's what we mean by context. And it's quite possible, of course, that there are inherently unconscious contexts which don't require a conscious experience to set up, so that the stage is always set, if you will, without the stage hands and the director and so on running around and getting things all set up. Well, there's now good evidence that many of our moods are shaped by events that are unconscious or no longer conscious, even when they still influence the way we feel. Now, contexts are a tricky subject to talk about, because by definition, they're unconscious, which means that it's hard to get a handle on them. Not impossible, but it takes some work. In our own lives, we can often make inferences about unconscious contexts that are influencing us at any given time. And in the sciences, we now have quite a lot of very good evidence for the role of contexts. And I will give you some examples. There are many other examples that you could research if you wanted to. So scientists of various kinds keep running into these funny, unexpected variables that change the way that people perceive the world and think and act. And a lot of the research over the last 100 years, and even longer, 200 years, has to do with making those kinds of discoveries, that there are just these rather mind-boggling things that nobody expects, that do shape the experiences of ourselves and of people who are subjects in experiments. So they keep on surprising those who do research in these fields. A very good example is given by the moon photo in the lecture for this week. And the name of that lecture, week five, is It's Dark Backstage. And why is it dark backstage? Well, dark is a metaphor for unconscious. The contexts that shape our conscious experience are unconscious, at least largely unconscious. And we have found just this nice little photo. It's actually a real photograph of this little ballerina looking down on a stage where there's a performance going on by somebody named De Keyser. It's a nice little image to keep in mind. Somebody else this week talked about the little elves that are running around in our unconscious, and we can use that as an image also. It's just a nice way to keep track of these ideas. So the moon picture is an interesting kind of illusion. Calling an illusion doesn't mean that it is always misleading. It is sometimes misleading. And I would like you to think about the times when it might be correct, when it might give you correct visual information about whether you are looking at a moon crater or maybe a hill on the moon, that is to say, something that is curving outward toward us, or something that is curving inward into the moon itself. This is an actual photograph of a part of the moon taken by a telescope, and we've been looking at those kinds of things, or at least astronomers have, since Galileo, and they've had to cope with a fundamental question, namely, are we looking at hills on the moon and all the other planets and so on, or are we looking at hollows? And I would like you to think about and give the answer in our discussions about under what conditions we believe that we're looking at hills and hollows. Now, I want you to keep in mind that this is not something, this influence that exists on our perception is not something that is conscious. It is clearly something that is powerful, because it's really important if you're an animal trying to survive in the world to know whether you're going to run down a hill or when you're going to run up a hill, whether you're going to fall in a hole or whether you're going to bump into something if you keep going. So that's a fundamental question for all creatures that have visual systems, and so we have some built-in assumptions that you and I don't think about consciously about the visual world that are contextual. Now, another good example, classic example, is the so-called Necker cube. The Necker cube is an illustration or an illusion that was discovered by a man named Necker in the 19th century. And it's a cute little one. You see it all over the place. That is a reversible wire box. And if you look at it, it'll just flip back and forth every several seconds. If you have a lot of experience looking at it, it will flip quite quickly. Now, what you can do is roll up a piece of paper and look through one eye at a corner of a regular room, what we call a carpentered room, because carpenters like to work with square corners. It makes life a lot easier for carpenters. So we tend to build square rooms because they're efficient, they make good use of space, they're easy to build, and so on. And so a carpentered room of any kind, if you simply take that rolled up piece of paper and looked with one eye at a corner of the room, an inside corner, you'll see that you can flip it back and forth. And that means that we interpret corners contextually. That is to say, we're always walking into the room with a set of assumptions about the space that we inhabit, and if we are used to living in carpenter rooms, if we are in that kind of culture, we have plenty of experience that shapes that context, which frames our conscious experience of the room. A closely related example is called the Ames Distorted Room. I don't have an example of the Ames Distorted Room, but I Googled it this morning, and there are lots of nice examples on the web if you just type in Ames Room. Ames is spelled A-M-E-S. You'll get all kinds of nice examples, named after Adalbert Ames, who was an architect in Boston, I believe, in the United States, in the 1920s approximately, and was hanging around with a very interesting bunch of people who have been quite influential in psychology. Among them are people with a lot of Gestalt psychology background, which obviously is closely related to this. Well, an Ames room is really a distorted room, but it doesn't look distorted because, as you know, when we look at a rectangular wall from the side, in fact, the pattern of light that falls on our retinas is not a rectangular pattern at all, but it is a trapezoidal pattern. And so Ames, as an architect, was very much aware of that and thought, well, what if we set it up in such a way that we build a trapezoidal room, a room consisting of entire trapezoids, and fool the eye into thinking that these are rectangular rooms? What will happen? Well, one of the things that happens is that if you have people walking inside of such a room, they will seem to shrink and grow quite spectacularly as they come closer to our eyes, of course, and go farther away from our eyes. But, of course, the room distorts the space around them in such a way that we don't realize that they're getting closer and walking farther away. Rather, what our visual system tends to do is to create a context around them and interpret their retinal image, the image that falls on the retina, as a change in size. It's just as if you were to imagine a car that's several blocks away from you as being actually smaller than the same car when it came up really close. Obviously, we know that it isn't, but we know that it isn't because we put it in a certain spatial context. So I would claim, and others would claim, that contexts exist in everything that you and I experience, in social relationships, in cultural assumptions that we make, in intellectual matters like the sort of things we talk about in this course, in interpersonal relationships, in science. In fact, the history of science, to some extent, is the history of people misunderstanding things and until they find the right context for interpreting scientific evidence. One famous example of that, of course, is the story of Galileo and Copernicus and Newton and those folks who figured out that if we shift our point of view on the planets in the solar system, and we look at those planets from the sun, we'll see all the planets rotating around us in something very close to a circle. It turns out to be an ellipse, but it's close enough to a circle for most of the planets so that it's a good first approximation to think of the solar system as consisting of a bunch of planets going in circles around the sun. That requires a context shift because historically, of course, we all tend to think that the world rotates around our heads, not around the sun. and it's something of a shock culturally for entire civilizations to discover that that's not so. There are spiritual contexts, the sorts of frameworks that people use to give meaning to their lives. There are political contexts, there are economic contexts, and so on. Context is one of the fundamental tools with which we approach our experiences, our experiential reality in the world. In music, composers constantly work on setting the stage for the next sound that we hear. If the music changes keys from A major to D minor, you will hear the difference and you'll respond emotionally, even if you don't have the remotest idea what A major and D minor really mean to a musician. It just happens to be part of our human brain and culture, which is very smart musically. And that, in fact, is one of the very interesting puzzles that we can ask about human brains and cultures. Namely, what's this thing about music? How come we're so sensitive to music? It's like language, you know, it's something that is appears to be very specific to our species, but we're not sure why. Well, personality features can also be considered as contexts. That is to say, they are major factors that influence our ways of experiencing the world, and they influence us all of the time. But it's not as if we walk around, most of us, saying, gee, I'm an extrovert, or I'm an introvert, or I'm sensitive, or I'm insensitive. In fact, especially, I don't notice people walking around saying they're insensitive, even if they are. Now, perfectionism is an interesting example that's discussed in our lecture for this week, and perfectionism is something that is extremely common in a culture like ours, in which achievement is so highly valued. But it's not just in our culture, because after all, achievement is highly valued in hunter-gatherer cultures as well, and in farming cultures, and in fishing cultures, and so on. There are all kinds of cultures that value achievement, and one of the things that happens in those kinds of cultures is that the desire to achieve and the ways in which we control ourselves in order to achieve become so highly practiced that they become automatic. So all of us have been through school exams from first grade onward, and every time many of us approach an exam, it's rather anxiety-provoking, and then we study, and we learn hard, and we stay up the night before, and then when we've done the exam and we've passed it good and well enough for our purposes, most of us discount what we've achieved, because after all, most of our friends achieve the same thing. We don't give ourselves much credit for it, and that is an interesting thing, because we end up very often forgetting how to give ourselves credit for our achievements. And that can be a problem. That is, in fact, something that people in the field of cognitive behavioral therapy have discovered is a very, very common thing in the causation of depression, which can range from very minor passing change of mood to a lifelong chronic kind of serious depression. So that's a very interesting thing, because perfectionism by itself, of course, is just another context. It's something that we learn, and we interpret our experience of our next hurdle that we want to jump in life in terms of our previous hurdles that we have jumped. We all want it to be perfect, and even if we end up not being perfect, like everybody does, we need to interpret things according to our framework, whatever our assumptions are. And you don't have to be a perfectionist, of course. All you have to do is to desire to perform well. and you will have a framework for performance that is very much like that. And the framework for self-evaluation and self-judgment, judgment of others, and so on. And those frameworks become largely unconscious. And because they become largely unconscious, they sometimes entrap us. So that, in a way, we lose control because we are no longer doing this consciously. I think it's perfectly useful to set up a performance set of goals for ourselves. That's how we make it through life. That's how we get important things accomplished. That's how society can be a beneficial thing for human beings, and so on. And also, frequently, because it becomes unconscious, we lose the choice to make. So one of the things one does in cognitive behavioral therapy is bring those things to mind again so that you can choose again whether or not you want to be perfectionistic or have a high standard for some particular hurdle that you may think may be thinking of jumping in life. So that is a humanly very relevant thing, especially for high achievers, and most of the people in this course, no doubt, are high achievers, so it's something that you may want to think about. And our PLAB for this week is an illustration of an aspect of that whole cluster of very interesting and important phenomena. Well, in science, as I mentioned before, the effects of context can be seen throughout all history, and the same thing is true in any other kind of human endeavor that involves some kind of goal, some kind of problem solving. It can be seen in the history of politics. It can be seen in the history of social movements. I think I mentioned science. One of the most typical things, by the way, that happens in science is that scientists get stuck in some belief system that works part of the time, but not all of the time. And the best example that I know right now is the example of Einstein, who was a pretty smart person, but he really couldn't stand quantum mechanics because, as he said, the Lord does not play dice with the universe. And quantum mechanics, of course, is a probabilistic way of looking at the physical world. Einstein was born into a world in which physics was not probabilistic, but deterministic, and he just didn't like it at all. That's not what God does, according to Einstein. Well, physicists today believe that Einstein was wrong on that, although he was wrong in a very creative way, as it turns out, which is rather nice. But nevertheless, on that particular point, most physicists today would disagree. So in any case, it can happen to anybody, and I would guess indeed that it does happen to everybody in human history. And to the extent that we actually keep track of the kinds of problems that people are trying to solve in various aspects of life, we can see people getting stuck in certain contexts, and often not even realizing that there was any context there at all. Take an example. Suppose you see an elderly person striking a cat with a stick. Now, most of us would be pretty angry at the person who was hitting the cat. Fortunately, cats are very fast and tend to run away right away. But now, suppose we know that the elderly attacker just had a stroke and has had damage to his or her frontal lobes, which have the function of inhibiting impulsive behavior. So if a person, an elderly person, starts behaving in an impulsive way all of a sudden, your medical doctor immediately thinks, got to check out to see if they are okay in terms of their frontal lobes. Once we find that out, we change our whole way of perceiving the scene. We think of this as a person who might need some help, as well as the cat. So we constantly, in a way, that's very much like the Necker cube. We can flip back and forth with a social interaction like that, with understanding that, in the same way that we can flip back and forth with the Necker cube. Contexts like that are constantly shaping our experience, and I would like to encourage you to do the exercise in the P-Lab for this week. PDFs for the P-Lab and the lecture are on the news page of the D2L University of Arizona system, and they are also available on my own website, the PBWiki website. It will take you about 5 minutes to do the exercise. So let me finish with announcements. Chapter 5 of the textbook is online because some people still have not received their textbooks. So I believe it's at the bottom of the news page. And there are some additional readings. Finally, we have some advanced readings. We have a number of advanced readings on my website and also at the bottom of the news page. You're very welcome to take a look at them and to download anything you're interested in. In particular, we have about a dozen readings. These are articles, typically, that have been published on the subject of brain rhythms. Brain rhythms have been known since 1929. They can be picked up very easily by putting some electrodes on somebody's head and picking up the electrical activity of the brain underneath the scalp. There's a great deal that has been done in that, but until quite recently, they have been very puzzling. And now we understand them a great deal better, and there are two respects in which brain rhythms are important to us in this course. It's now been shown that a number of different brain rhythms have a very intimate relationship with consciousness, and we're beginning to understand why that might be so. And secondly, we have actually quite a bit of information about higher states of consciousness and the kinds of changes in brain rhythms that seem to occur with advanced meditators. And that is important, but until recently, it was just kind of a raw fact. That is to say, it was out there. We knew, for example, for the last 20 years at least, that the alpha rhythm, which goes a nice little sine wave, a very regular little rhythm that you can pick up from the back of the head, that we've known about for 78 years by now, but we've never understood what it actually did. So one of the things that we're very fortunate about is that some of these brute facts, some of these raw pieces of evidence are now understandable because we have some reasonably good ideas of the function that they have in the brain. And that gives us, guess what? It gives us a context for understanding this evidence. So Dr. Montandon's discussion group, which is on Sundays, but also I think Dr. Montandon will answer questions asynchronously. If you just post them during the week. Dr. Montana's discussion group will focus on brain rhythms and consciousness. If you are interested, please join him on Sundays or leave a post during the week. And with that, we can get back to Alexander's Ragtime Band with 1920s flappers dancing back and forth, jumping back and forth in their Charleston rags. And for this week's audio talk for Consciousness, the web course, we will conclude. As you go along in this course, keep an eye out for context effects. I think you will find them to be very important and revealing and all pervasive. Thanks very much. Take you by the hand to the man, who's later on.